welcome back to another episode of The Streaming Heap. As we're approaching the finale, things are heating up. Mutiny, war, submersible, exploring the Titanic. Let's stop talking about the end of the world, though. We're going to be talking about the silo today.
We're going to find out the whole thing is really controlled by a PS2 controller.
Excuse me, it was a Logitech controller. It was a Logitech PS2 controller. It wasn't even official first party. My name is Lynn. I'll be your host today. And the other voice you hear is Eric McGill, the unapologetic geek himself, my usual co-host. Hello, Eric.
Hello. I'm going to say in my perfectly normal voice.
And I thank you for it.
You're welcome.
We're going to try and not do too many submersible jokes today, but like we're overfed on the memes and
how we feel about rich people. Come on.
Like, look, we're not applauding anyone's death, but also at the same time, they pay so much money to get into this death trap.
If you're going to spend that much money, really, just do some research.
Oh, God. Reading interviews with the owner from the past has been a fucking trip because the guy who was trying to sell monorail to Springfield.
Springfield, yeah. I just can't help but see the dramatic irony in the whole thing. It's the Titanic all over again. It's just hubris. Anyway, yep. We shouldn't talk about this right now. We should move on.
Yes, correct. So we're going to be talking about Silo episode 9 today. But as usual, we're going to be, you know, shooting the shit a little bit, talking about some news, maybe not real life political news. We just make jokes about those.
Right.
Some stuff we've been watching. And of course, as always, Eric, who will never mutiny, because I have all the tanks, will be putting in the timestamps in the description today, won't you, Eric?
Yes, including for the section that I'm going to record by myself where I talk all shit about you.
Okay, so finally, Eric, you went and watched Guardians of the Galaxy 3.
I think I may have caught it in like the last week it's going to be out. So yeah, I finally saw it. And I loved it. And to be honest, just so that you know where I'm coming from, I didn't love the second one, Guardians of the Galaxy 2. I thought it was okay, but I don't love it like a lot of other people do. I think maybe it's just something about the emotional beats of that one didn't hit me very hard, probably because I have like a good father figure in my life. So like, I don't know.
Wow. Rude. Good for you. How about the rest of us?
No, it's just like, I don't know. I've only seen it a couple times. I haven't like gone back and rewatched it since it originally came out. So maybe I was just in a bad mood when part two came out. But like, yeah, I really digged the Christmas special, and I really like, I love the Guardians of the Galaxy, like as an IP, and I love the first movie. So I went into this.
All of my best friends are Guardians of the Galaxy.
So I went into this with high hopes, but like my expectations were a little tempered because I thought two was a little cheesy for me. But man, it hit me hard. It was really, really good.
Yeah.
It like even started with, you know, Creep, which I'm an 80s, 90s kid. That's like my anthem when I was in high school. So yeah, I get it.
Wasn't that your nickname in high school?
I like that it's all about Rocket. Like, we knew it was gonna be all about Rocket, but I like how they did it. We really get his backstory, the ins and outs of it, and the villain, the High Evolutionary, who is not Herbert Wyndham apparently, was great. He's a great villain, and I like him like as a one-off villain. I'm not sure, I mean, he's still technically alive at the end, but I'm not really sure if, I mean, full spoilers, by the way, I'm not really sure like if he would be a good recurring villain, you know, like usually in the MCU, I complain when villains die, like in their first appearance. But in this case, like the High Evolutionary, he's a good villain, but he's a really one note villain, right? Like there's not much more to him. But he is a great villain. I think I like him more than Ronan in the first Guardians of the Galaxy, obviously. He's about the same as Kurt Russell in like how I rank the villains.
Yeah, I mean, like, look, they didn't really have that much time to spend on Ronin in the first Guardians of the Galaxy because they have to introduce the six characters.
That's true, yeah. And I used to think it was Lee Pace's fault, but then I watched Foundation and I no longer feel that way. So,
oh, dude, you have to watch Pushing Daisies.
I know, you told me.
Lee Pace, seminal work. Yeah, Pushing Daisies ending when it did is a freaking cry. Hollywood has a lot to answer for. And I think that was actually the writer strike that ended the last one as well.
Probably, yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. But with this movie, I also like, I mean, it's James Gunn. He's really good at giving all of the characters their due. And in this one, like, a couple of different characters have really good arcs. I really appreciate how he handled the Gamora and Star-Lord thing. That was fine. Like, it was predictable, but it was fine. And but the one that really, like, surprised me was Drax's arc. Like, that one, it doesn't even start at the beginning. Like, it takes a while before Drax does anything in the movie. But then, like, once that starts and you start to ask what is Drax's value to the team? Why is he important? And obviously, it's very heavy-handed, but, like, I really, really like it. And that line where you're not a destroyer, you should be a father, or you should be a dad. That, like, it's cheesy, it's trite, but it hit me real hard. I really liked it.
Yeah. You know what this movie also proves, though? Nebula and Karen Gillan, who played Nebula, has been like an underrated MVP throughout the entire trilogy.
That's true, yeah.
Like, she has a really good arc. And I like how they hinted that there could be some sort of romance developing between her and Star-Lord in the future, but they didn't try to cram it in here. They definitely didn't try to cram it in the ending.
Yeah, they just did the thing where, like, it's possible going down in the future if they wanted to go that route, they could, but they don't have to. Yeah.
I really do like the exchange. They gave it away in all the trailers where he's just, like, staring at her. What are you looking at?
Never noticed your eyes. We're so black. Yeah. I also like that she was really close to Rocket, which makes a lot of sense if you think about it, because during the blip, they were the only two Guardians who were still alive. So, like, of course they would find some kind of bond. And of course, they're also both tortured to death and rebuilt, you know, they got a lot in common. So.
Yes. And they also did. They also chose well, making Star-Lord kind of, like, they still pretend he's the main character, but this is Rocket's movie.
This is totally Rocket's movie, even though he spends most of the movie in a coma, it's still his movie.
Yeah. And Star-Lord has a proper character arc still, though. But, like, they did the screenwriting trick when a character's character arc is done and you don't really need... You don't really need to give them on another journey. Like, you know, he has a little one, mostly to do with coming out of a depression over Gamora.
But right.
The way they got around is just they kept him angry for the majority of the movie. he didn't need to be nuanced because he's just mad. He's on a warpath.
I do like that the movie starts with, like, you know, heavy personal stakes. So, like, of course, that's why he would be mad the entire time. To the point where sometimes, especially in the beginning of the movie, like, a little bit of the quippiness seems a little out of place. But I don't know. It falls into the rhythm pretty fast. But there were a couple of times right in the beginning where, like, is this really a good time for a joke?
Well, I mean, that's the Guardians through and through, right? They are a pack of morons, like, emotionally stunted morons. I do like being reminded that Star-Lord is just a murderer. Like,
well, yeah, totally.
Like, when he was on Winden's ship, and he tells Groot, it's like, let's kill them all. do murder the entirety of these animal torturers.
That does bring one thing that kind of bugs me. Is it like, it does that thing where the hero has the villain at his mercy and decides not to kill him. Like, this is after we've got that badass hallway scene where they've just, like, slaughtered people left and right. Why would you leave him alive? Why would you leave this completely irredeemable mess alive?
Yeah, but that his ship exploded. I think he just didn't want the personal, like, and with this one, there's no ideology attached to it, so I don't mind. Like, I hated in Star Wars so much because they, like, if you strike me down in anger, I was like, well, like, what about all the stormtroopers you fucking murdered? Like,
right, exactly.
You weren't angry then? Like, you were having fun, so that's allowed? But here, I just feel like he didn't personally want to do the deed. It didn't matter anyway because the guy's about to die, right? He didn't want to indulge in the, like, it just marked him getting over the trauma that he no longer feel the need to personally and viciously murder him. Of course, they have personally and viciously maimed him.
I do like that the movie repeatedly, like, one of the running gags is Star-Lord saying it's not a trap, it's a face-off, and then they literally take his face off. Yeah. I love that. That's clever.
I mean, you saw it since the first time he said it, right?
Oh, of course, you know it. I mean, he's got his face, like, stuck on. You know it's coming off. I really like Cosmo and Kraglin, that back and forth. Him saying that she's a bad girl and won't, like, take it back.
Yeah. Bad dog.
And won't take it back, which is, you know, that's an evil thing to say to a dog.
Yeah. I really like that conversation where he's like, the Russians stuffed me in a rocket, fully knowing there's no other way for me to get back, and that I'm supposed to die in the cold loneliness of space. Even that is not
as bad. Being called a bad dog. And, you know, again, it's predictable. You know this is going to come back around. She's going to do something that's going to save his life. Of course that's going to happen. And he's going to call her a good dog. But in true James Gunn fashion, just because you see it coming doesn't make it any less impactful.
Yes. Yes. Adam Warlock seems a little bit tacked on, though. I feel like he's there because if James Gunn's knew if he didn't put Adam Warlock in this movie, he will spend the rest of his life asking, hey, what was your original plan with Adam Warlock?
True. Like, I say, okay, I'm going to say this as somebody who likes Adam Warlock in the comics.
Yeah.
I don't have a problem with kind of turning him into an idiot, like, because he's fresh out of the cocoon. I know I've heard some fans complain about Adam Warlock's portrayal in this movie, but I think it's fine. Adam Warlock is always a little weird. Like, there's always something not quite right about him because he's supposed to be this, like, higher dimensional being or whatever. But I thought it was fine because I think James Gunn in this movie, he's trying to make this point that people are now not inferior or superior. And that, like, once you start thinking that way, everything just falls apart. You start, like, idolizing idiots. And that's kind of where he's going with that with Warlock. I kind of see there's a thematic tie-in. But you're right. You could take out the entire Sovereign part of the story, and it wouldn't change anything.
Yeah.
I mean, instead of saving Star-Lord in the end, you could just have Star-Lord have his mask. You know? I mean, like, it's not that hard.
Yes. I have no complaint about how he's portrayed. I just don't think he needed to be in this movie.
Yeah, me either. And I like the actor. I've known him since, what was it? Was it like Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, I think? He's been around a while. I really like him. I think he's good as Adam Warlock.
He's in one of the Narnias. Well, he's in multiple of the Narnias movie, I believe.
Yeah, I think you're right.
He's also the, you guys are getting paid?
Yeah, that guy. I'm excited to see, like, him further down the line. Like, now that he's, like, in the Guardians, and we're going to see some of these characters again, obviously, because it's the MCU. So I'm curious to see what they wind up doing with him, because, like, they've established him with a backstory. They've separated him from his backstory, and he can do his own thing. Great. Similarly, I'm really excited to see what happens with Mantis, because knowing where Mantis goes in the comics, there's a lot of potential there.
And didn't she escape with an army of obelisks?
Yeah, she has like three of them. Yeah.
Yeah. They all went their separate, like, she went alone, right? And Drax stuck with Nebula too.
Right.
And Gamora went their separate way, and Peter's went back to his grandfather.
Just talk about mowing the lawn, yeah.
Yeah. It does seem like I know it's very subtle, but the after credit scene does seem to indicate that they are probably going to move Star-Lord to, like, a more responsible position, you know? Like, because it's just a joke, but, like, it is Star-Lord talking to his grandfather about somebody else who doesn't have their life together.
Right.
So I feel like if they do like a 3-year time skip, if you bring back a less goofy, more mature Star-Lord, I think we would let them get away with it. Like, right? Like, if
no, he, of course. And I think that's been like his character arc from the very beginning. He started from complete and utter man child and has very slowly learned to grow up.
Yeah. And if they said he lived a normal life on Earth for a few years and like learned to be a functional human being, and then wait, the adventure calls again. I'm like, yeah, that's fine. You know?
And that would be why they would call him the legendary Star-Lord, which is what he's called in the comics. Yeah.
Yes. Perfect first F-bomb for the MCU.
it comes in, it just like, I almost failed to notice that it was an F-bomb. Yeah. Like I heard it and I thought it was funny, but I'm like, wait, did somebody just say fuck in the MCU?
Yeah, there's no fanfare, it's not a big moment, it is a perfect, get in the fucking...
Apparently that was improv, the script.
And it's also believable because those cars are ship bombs.
Right, yeah. It's like an 80s station wagon.
What not? Get it, open the fucking door. speaking of MCU F-bombs, here's another show where that feels like it want to drop some F-bombs but haven't been allowed to yet. We both watched episode 1 of Secret Invasion.
Yes. I mean, Samuel Jackson, he's tried a couple of times to drop an F-bomb.
Yeah.
But one time he got blipped, another time he got, like, sounded out. So, yeah.
How are you feeling about this show?
Tentatively, I'm excited. It seems like it's a little bit of a slow burn. It's not Secret Invasion, like, as we, you and I know it from the comics, which is fine, because Secret Invasion from the comics is actually kind of dumb. Sorry to say.
Yes, that's what I'm. Can we address that fucking first? Because it came out in the news. I don't know if you saw that or not. That Kevin Feige told the director, because the director asked. Director's like, okay, how much research into Secret Invasion from the comics do I need to do? And Kevin Feige's like, oh, don't bother, that's not really what we're doing here.
Right.
And then people have been like, look how far the MCU has fallen. Oh, is this the same guy that smuggled in the X-Men comics when the director forbid his... Because he was producer in the original X-Men. The director forbid the cast from reading the X-Men comics. And then he's like, he smuggled them in to like let them read it. Yeah, that's a different fucking situation. He's 100% right. This show that they're doing have nothing to do with Secret Invasion from the comic, except Skrulls. It's a Skrull invasion of Earth, but it's a completely different situation. Skrulls are not bad guys in this. These are clearly radicalized refugees. They're doing an Israeli-Palestine kind of situation here, okay? It's a lot more nuanced. The director reading about the fucking Skrull Queen isn't going to help him make this film. And let me tell you, they don't have any of the pieces they require to adapt that story. They don't have Spider-Woman, okay?
Right,
Spider-Woman,
very true.
And obviously, none of the heroes are going to be in this, and I don't know who need to hear this. Secret Invasion, the comic, sucks. It's not good, okay? It's bullshit Deus Ex Machina. That's just all the superheroes you've been enjoying for the past few years. They've been secretly aliens for a while. You're like, what? And then they're like, I don't know, fight scenes. And then it ends.
And you can pull that off in the comics, but if you do that in the MCU and you try to like retcon characters to being Skrulls for a long time, that's not going to work. That's not going to sit well with the audience at all. No pun intended with Sitwell.
Sitwell's dead.
But like, and take Civil War. Like, I don't hate the Civil War comics. I think they were fine. I actually kind of like a couple of them. But like, the Civil War movie and the Civil War comic arc are almost completely different things. Like, they're very, very separate. And I'm fine with that. I love Civil War the movie. I like Civil War the comics. They don't have to be the same. I know you feel a little bit differently. Yeah.
About the comic. I like the movie.
But like, I do have a lot of Falcon and Winter Soldier concerns about Secret Invasion, the show. Like, I'm worried that it might go in that direction and be a little jumbled and convoluted. But at least it doesn't have the pandemic as an excuse. So we'll see what happens. But they do have the writer's strike.
Not just the writer's strike, but you could immediately tell why they haven't been fucking promoting this show, though. Like, the show is so tied into Cold War era Russia versus American politics as well.
That's true,
like,
yeah.
And then, like trying to trick Russia into invading countries. Like, that was the beginning of the plot. And I'm like, oh. I guess. And also, episode one just dropped, and then suddenly mutiny in Russia. Can real life events just calm down for a little bit? So, you know, you can actually advertise their show without going, oh shit, oh fuck, oh no.
I will say, though, visually, the show is really good. Like, it's obviously taking a lot of cues from classic, you know, Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, the Third Man, and stuff like that. You know, you can see it in the cinematography. You can see it in some of the set designs. Yes. I like how random characters will walk by the screen and they'll have something that you can notice, like the rainbow ball. And then that character turns up later as a Skrull, and you're like, wait a minute, was that a Skrull the first time? And I love shit like that. I love it.
Yeah.
And I think that's where the show is doing really, really well. Not entirely sold on what they're doing with Nick Fury as a character, but let's see how that pans out.
I actually want to get into that a little bit. Like, first of all, the cinematography.
Spot on.
Fucking nailed it. And like, people criticize MCU for being samey all the time. Some of the complaints are not valid. It's just easy to say MCU follows a formula. The formula, obviously they follow a formula. No shit. It's the same studio, same producer. They try to construct a coherent universe. But they do let people diverge, and sometimes in bad ways as well.
True. Like,
sometimes divergent does not help them in any way, shape, or form. But they are right in that cinematography-wise, MCU is hardly ever exciting, hardly ever go beyond like acceptable, and sometimes dip under acceptable. So it's actually quite nice to see MCU doing quite unique, quite inspired cinematography. I love that scene where Skrull, Agent Ross is running up where Talos is chasing him, and it's just from the outside and you just see the lights come on the stairwells.
Oh yeah, that was really cool.
And it comes on faster and faster because they're running faster and faster.
That's perfect.
Wow, nice.
Yeah.
Like, I know this is like, I know I wouldn't be praising it that much if it wasn't MCU. I know MCU haters be like, oh, Edian's learning cinematography for the first time from the MCU. No, I'm just saying they don't need to go above and beyond. They're doing. So let's give them a little bit of a kudos.
And I'm not going to sit here and tell you the cinematography is like the greatest. It's not even the best the MCU has done. I think the best the most experimental and best cinematography in the MCU is probably Werewolf by Night, actually.
Eternals!
The Eternals! Just turn off all the lights, yeah.
Hey, I actually really enjoyed the cinematography in Eternals.
No, I'm teasing. Like, this, like, the Eternals did a really good job at showing you vistas and things that were pretty. It was the action scenes that I think the Eternals kind of, the cinematography falls apart a little.
And after watching The Flash, you really appreciate the speedstar scenes.
I guess that's true, yeah.
But yeah, Werewolf by Night is really nailed it too. But it does annoy me that they seem to be limiting all their experimentation on the TV side.
Yeah, that's true. Side. Like, they haven't really done a lot of experimenting in the movies. I think it is hurting them. Yeah.
Well, because when they did the big experimentation with the Eternals, it blew up in their faces.
That's true, yeah. I like Eternals. I defend the Eternals all the time. But yeah.
I mean, I still don't think it's a great movie. Like,
no, it's definitely flawed, and I agree with a lot of the criticisms. I just think they're a little overblown.
Yes. And also, second, the thing you brought up, Nick Fury. They are referencing a character that doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Nick Fury at its height, Nick Fury, the kick-ass agent, hasn't been really fleshed out. Yes, we got some of it in Captain Marvel, and obviously this show is calling back to Captain Marvel a lot because Skrulls were also introducing Captain Marvel.
Right.
But even then, like, it wasn't his movie. It's not like he was competent, he was a good agent. It's not like, and it wasn't like a spy movie either. Like, we never seen him as a kick-ass super spy that they all are referring to before. And it is a little bit jarring that everybody is like, every single character is telling the audience about, like, trust me, Nick Fury was awesome. Not this pathetic shamble right here. And that made me kind of feeling like, I kind of enjoy the Nick Fury I'm watching. Please stop telling me how pathetic he is.
And honestly, like, I do like what they're doing with him. And I do like that, like, when he's introduced on Earth, he, like, immediately is out of step. Like, visual metaphor, perfect.
Yeah.
But, like, this isn't the first time he's been out of step. This isn't the first time he's been caught off on the wrong foot. He was almost the villain in Winter Soldier, don't forget.
Yeah.
So, like, he's never been the super spy from the comics. He's just been a guy who's playing, like, you know, multiple dimensional chess with more information than any one human should have. And yeah, it's true. He has lost and maybe he doesn't feel like he has all that information anymore, but it still feels like this is an unearned character progression to me. Cause it's, I don't know.
Did you notice though that right now, if you go to the Disney Plus front page, obviously Secret Invasion is the headline, but the next, banner over is Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. And that hasn't happened in a long time. Ever. That hasn't happened ever. They have not advertised
why is Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. ever? That's weird.
Because I think the reason is the one show that did show Nick Fury is a super spy. Whenever they have access to Samuel L. Jackson is Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. They did kind of use him as their Avenger, you know?
That is true, and he did crop up on the show a lot, like at least once a season. So
and he did crop on the show a lot, and he did awesome things in there. So maybe that's what they're like. Oh, this is the height of Fury, and of course that's going to just reignite the sparks of is Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. canon or not again. And my point is, it doesn't matter. The parts they like are going to be canon, and Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. actually started doing like time travel and stuff in like season 4 and 5 anyway, so they can easily discard that as an alternate timeline.
Right. I mean, like, they've introduced the whole multiverse thing to stop questions like that from being asked. You know, like, canonicity is not as critical as you people think it is.
I mean, it's not going to, like, it is in fact just causing more questions. It's like, which universe is this? But where the episode 1 ended, exciting, not super stoked that they killed off Maria Hill that quickly, because I was looking forward to her having a lot of screen times in this show, but I guess that sucks to be her, I guess.
I mean, it's a first episode, they've got to do a couple of dramatic things to get your attention, like turning Ross into a Skrull, that was like a perfect thing to do. Obviously, Ross has not always been a Skrull. Stop thinking that way. That's not the way it works. Ross is probably still alive in that warehouse.
Or in Wakanda.
Because that's where
they don't need to kidnap the people to steal the identity. They only kidnap the people if they want to go deep cover as those people, because obviously there's some sort of memory device that they are using it to access their memory properly. And you can't have, if you want to go deep cover as somebody, you can't have two of you running around. It makes sense to kidnap the original. I doubt Ross is even kidnapped. I bet Ross is in like Wakanda somewhere.
You might be right. Yeah. I mean, but my point is still, you know, Ross is still alive. It's not, they didn't kill off Ross.
No.
But killing Maria Hill, like, yeah, it's dramatic. Yeah. It's a big step, but it didn't have the emotional impact on me that it seems to have had on everybody else. Like, I'm like, okay, yeah, Maria Hill died, whatever. Moving on.
Oh, well, I care. I care. She was Robin Schabowski. No, I just like Maria Hill. And also, like, she cropped up in a bunch of things and Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
But for the sake of the show, it makes perfect sense to isolate Nick Fury. Like, he's got to be completely on his own. Like, that's the only way this is going to play out. At some point, he's got to be isolated from Talos. And Talos and him are still going to be basically working towards the same goal. But I think it's somehow they're going to get isolated from each other. But I mean, because that's just how this kind of story has to play out.
Oh, he's gonna get a John Wick moment. He's gonna get a moment where he go get his leather trench coat and he's like, "I'm back."
Oh, for sure. I mean, that's how it's gonna end. Out that
Nick Fury is back.
Yeah.
Well, I was hoping it happens like next episode.
No,
I don't need the show spending another 4 episodes telling me how pathetic Nick Fury is. I'm like, he's fine. He's doing fine. Stop being so mean to Nick Fury. I will say though, one thing I really enjoyed, the easy bromance friendship between Talos and Nick Fury. I'm really enjoying a lot. It surprised me. I didn't expect it, but as soon as they showed it, I was like, oh yeah, that makes sense. What did you buy for your midlife crisis? The Avengers.
And I do like Mendo as like the world weary Talos who's like been kicked out and who's, you know, just sad and kind of like still doing, going through the motions, still trying to save the planet and everything, but like he's obviously tired. I like that. I like his acting in this.
You can't call him Mando. We have a different Mando
now. Oh, sorry. Mendo. He's not Mando, he's Mendo.
Okay, well, I feel like we have dedicated enough time to the MCU half hour.
I knew this was going to go long. I knew it was.
Yeah. But yeah, no, like Secret Invasion, I'm excited too. Like, I wasn't excited until the episode dropped, you know. I was like, oh, Secret Invasion is coming out, you know. but after I watched it, I'm like, yeah, okay, like this is cool. So yeah. We'll and, probably check in again.
There's one other thing I wanted to bring up about Secret Invasion, and it's all the people who are pissed off about the AI.
Yeah.
The opening credits were done with AI as a tool, but it was still like contracted out to a company that has artists who worked on it, who touched it up, who, you know, fed it the proper material. Like, it wasn't like keeping artists out of the loop. It was just using AI as an additional tool. And I think that's fine. If you're going to use AI, do it that way. It's not like they were trying to save a buck and weren't hiring artists. They were still hiring people to do it. So I just want to say that.
Okay. I don't completely disagree with you, but I do want to say, yeah, you're right. They are like they are like raging vitriol that is not taking into context.
It's a little over the top. Yeah.
Yeah. But I do want to say that, though, this is how it starts.
you're not wrong. Yeah, and it is something to worry about. But like,
this is how it's,
I don't think,
because
this is what you should be that up in arms about.
This should not be the hill we die on. But I feel like, yeah, people should yell a little bit, because this is how it starts. Because if you look at the credits, the amount of people that is, the amount of artists that is involved in this creation of this opening sequence is 1/3 of the amount of artists that usually get involved with the creation of opening credits.
Well, sure.
It fit the theme of the show as well. Like, so it isn't like it doesn't seem like a complete hatchet job, but also fuck that. It's ugly.
I don't like it. Like, I honestly don't like it. I don't like the AI aesthetic at all. I think it is ugly and it's disturbing. It's like off.
Yeah.
It's not even Uncanny Valley. It's just like watercolor running into itself. It's not.
Yeah.
It's not that visually interesting. And I think it's a very limited tool in its utility. So
it's soulless. It's soulless.
Yeah, it is. And it's obviously like, soulless. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. MCU, just. Do better. Just okay. You're the one who's breaking this fucking industry. You can't turn to AI. Okay. Like, yeah, obviously we enjoy and analyze the MCU output, but we can't, like, no, we don't, we can't agree with that bullshit about the fucking over the artists. Like, not the AI thing.
How they treat the digital artists. I mean, they've basically decimated the entire industry with how they treat them. So yeah.
Yeah. Yeah,
like, if you want to get upset, you can get upset about that.
Yeah,
but I don't think this is the reason to be upset. Yeah. You know, yeah.
And that's the thing you need to hold Kevin Feige's feet to the fire for, not the fact that he told his director not to read the pointless comic. Okay, so we're gonna take, after that little rant, we're gonna take a little break, and when we come back, we're gonna be talking about Silo episode 9. Exciting time.
Woohoo! Silo! I don't know how that came. Sorry.
went back to venture down or up the silo, up and then down. They travel up and down the silo a lot.
Yeah, we start going down.
Yeah, so we're gonna talk about the silo episode 9 today. Things are heating up. Things are heating up. I'm so glad that coup didn't start World War III before we could finish the season.
Well, you know, we still got another week.
This is true. This is true. Look, there are a lot of movies I'm looking forward to. Can we not do a nuclear nuclear war? That's all I ask. No need to rush. Climate change is going to get us anyway. And then we can all live the silo instead of watching the silo. Okay. How are you feeling, like, in this final stretch? How are you feeling going into episode 9?
I'm enjoying it. Like, it's good. I'm liking the way it's handling action and how it's drip-feeding information. I like how it's handling the characters. You know, I'll have nitpicks that I feel like I have to have some nitpicks, and I will tell them to you. But, like, for the most part, I'm still really high on this show. Like, a lot of my reservations have kind of fallen by the wayside, so...
Okay, well, let's start with a little recap of what happened this episode.
Is storyteller Lin still on strike?
He's still on strike, but his friend have a headache and took half a tablet of codeine and is just now winging it. Lin is here.
Lin the scab.
Yeah. So this episode is another example of Juliet following her patented ABE system. Always be escalating. did Sims threaten her? Arrest Sim. Did Sim make her a fugitive and punch her in the stomach? Kidnap his family. I cannot help but respect that woman. Like, I cannot tell whether or not her instincts are destructive or on point, because her instincts are just like, always be escalating, always be escalating.
I just think she has no chill. That's all it is.
I think she had chills, and then Sims and the Raiders threw him off a stairwell, and now she has nothing but rage. So as Juliet escalates things in every way she possibly could, she finally get into the drive and find some incriminating evidence, including a video from her long dead boyfriend, which cleared up once and for all that I suspected that the show was going to pull this. Like, he did change his mind. He did love her. And this is a trusted source. He was recording like a dead, like, I'm probably going to be dead.
He was probably going to be dead. Yeah.
So, like, it cannot be a manipulation. And also, look at that human hurricane. How can you not fall in love with that?
I mean, I love her. Yeah. No, I think it's genuine too. Just because, like, again, I go back to nuts and bolts storytelling. You know, you got to give her some reason to be hope. Or have hope and to have some faith in humanity. Otherwise, it's just like she's solving all
otherwise
these mysteries.
It's just Walking Dead. Just,
yeah, and, yeah, exactly. Then it just becomes Walking Dead at that point. It's, you know, exhausting. We have enough shows of The Walking Dead. We don't need like a 27th. Yeah.
That new Walking Dead Dead City is coming out. I know some people were very excited. I don't know. I like that guy. I like
I like the guy who plays Negan. He's really cool. Yeah. And I will admit that, like, poster with the like zombified Statue of Liberty is kind of cool looking. But that's about as far as I'll go. I'm not
doesn't
actually
make any
watch
fucking
it.
Sense.
Yeah.
Doesn't make any fucking sense. And as always, as they do it in every single posters featuring the parts of Statue of Liberty, too big. too big. That's not Statue of Liberty.
Yeah, the Statue of Liberty is actually pretty small. I just saw it a couple weeks ago.
Yeah. Now I can. I always knew that as a fact, but I can. Now that I've actually been to New York, I can say no. That's too big. It's not that big. The Cloverfield is the worst offender because the Statue of Liberty's head rolled down like Fifth Avenue or whatever, and it's just like taking out like buildings through the side, and I'm like, that's which statue, which Godzilla sized statue did you get that from?
Yeah, when Matt Reeves was asked about it, he said, look, I'm making a kaiju movie, so we're just going to say the Statue of Liberty is kaiju sized. It's an artistic decision.
Anyway, going back to the story, though, just a quick recap. Of course, Bernard and Sims is masked off. We finally get to see a lot of how the operations work. And Bernard himself doesn't necessarily feel 100% in control. He seemed to be panicking. He seemed to be a... look, I'm just saying, Juliet seemed to be a really good wrench into his system.
Well, the thing you can never say about Juliet is that she's not a second guesser. Whereas this episode immediately establishes that Bernard is having second thoughts. Like, because he pours out a drink of alcohol and then immediately pours it back into the bottle. Like, he's having a crisis where he doesn't exactly know what he's supposed to do next. And that plays out a couple of times. We'll see it throughout the episode.
Yes. So, that's pretty much what we have this episode. She recruits more people. She brings more innocent bystanders into her disaster zone. That is her path through the silo.
A Kool-Aid whirlwind.
She bring in what's his face, the criminal she's been harassing,
Patrick.
and another porter / IT guy.
Right.
And with their help is how she got into the hard drive, and it ends with her finding out the video we saw in episode one.
Yeah, she finally gets something really important off the hard drive, and it's something we've already seen. Damn it, so frustrating. But no, I'm kidding.
Oh, and of course, we find out a little bit more about what George was looking for, but we'll get to that later. So all right, let's start with at the beginning of the episode. Let's talk about Juliet's escape.
So Juliet jumps off of the ledge and does exactly what I predicted. She just lands on the ledge below. Like, that was obvious. There was no like magical way she was gonna survive. There was no other way this was gonna go.
they do that thing that I hate, that's when shows do, and animes is really bad at this. Anime is a bad offender at this, where they would end the cliffhanger with a shot, and when they redo it at the beginning of the next episode, the shot will be slightly different, and I'm like, which one happened? Because
that's not what bleeping happened. Shut up, Annie Wilkes. I get it.
But you get what I mean, right?
Oh, I totally get it. And I kind of suspected that was gonna happen.
At the end of the last episode, they pause. The three that's left behind, they look over their ledge and they pause to enough moments that you think she disappeared, or like obviously we know as an audience she didn't fucking die, but you think she just jumped down and disappeared. But in this episode, no, they pause a split second required to look down, and then they immediately
start
running. Down.
Right. No, I
agree. That's bullshit. I agree that
it's cheap and it's bullshit, and I think the show is better than that. But like I said, I kind of knew that's what we were gonna get, so I wasn't that surprised. I wasn't that put off by it.
Yes. But yeah, I don't know. Don't use that anime trick.
And, you know, she did stumble a little bit. She had a hard time getting up. But then, once she, starts running again, she's fine. I'm not really sure that any, complications to it.
Yeah. She didn't jump down that far. And also, she was smart about, where she jumped to. Like, it was harder for them to get there than for her to recover and run away.
Like, it was far enough that they weren't just going to jump down and follow her. Yeah.
Yeah. Especially not Mr. Shaky. Let's get to him later. Okay, so what do you... Let's start with her decision to immediately make it personal for Sims.
I like you, I kind of love it just for the sheer gall of it.
Yeah.
But like it makes sense. Like she's trying to get somebody with SysOp clearance, and who better than Sims? But like the fact that she goes so far as to hold his family literally at gunpoint. Like, Jesus Christ, lady.
To be fair, she didn't brought a gun. She brought a knife.
That's true.
Yeah, she had the gun. Really good world building here, like just with visual stuff, and really good at establishing characters very quickly. The interaction between Sims' wife and the Raiders, natural way for us to immediately be told that her wife used to be a Raider. Like it wasn't unnatural. Like it was like
it made perfect sense, and it was obviously a relevant character trait going forward. Like this is information we needed delivered in an organic way. Yeah.
Yes. And it like immediately established the dynamic, right? He's like, oh, like he doesn't have like a helpless stay-at-home wife that he's like looking out for. Like she is a firecracker.
It also gave her like motivation to let Juliet escape later. Because like she knows what Raiders will do if they bust in, you know, guns drawn. Like that's very believable. I buy that.
Yes. And like it also make her a really believable character.
Yeah.
You know, like a and
you get like history, you get motivation, and you like understand her as, I mean, she's a mother, she cares about keeping her family safe, and like she's an ex-Raider, so she knows how Raiders operate. You know, she's a well-rounded person. She's not just a cookie cutter character who just serves the plot, you know, like I appreciate that a lot.
And once she pulled out that fucking Glock, I was surprised, like, because that's a modern pistol. So far, all the guns we've seen on this is like a six shooter that could be from the Cowboys era. Shotgun designs hasn't changed that much unless you're moving into like a tactical, like,
yeah, but it wasn't like a tactical assault shotgun, it was just a regular old pump action.
Yeah, you know? This is the first time we've seen a modern gun, and it also makes sense that Sims has reserved modern guns to like his family, you know.
Good point. Yeah
like immediately I'm like, oh okay, like it makes sense that like this, she probably got that from Sims. her little boy might be a little bit bloodthirsty.
I hope she goes out to clean that bitch. Whoa, kid.
I thought it was going to head to Sim's wife overseeing something really damning and incriminating in the video or on the hard drive that she changed her mind. I'm glad it didn't go that way. She didn't much care about the truth. She didn't much care. She just like, hey, get the shit out of here.
You know? Yeah, she recognized that Juliet cared about it. Like she didn't, I don't think she was even really listening to it. So yeah, and she used that as a tactical advantage, because all she cared about in that moment was keeping her son safe, right? So, like, whatever was going to be on that hard drive, she wasn't going to care that much. And like you, I kind of thought that's where it was going, that she was, like, going to sneak up on her and was, like, about to hit her over the head or something, and then George would say something, and she'd be like, what? You know, but I'm like you, I'm also glad they didn't do that. That's kind of stupid.
George would be like, yeah, turns out Sim has been deep frying people and eating them like KFC. but at the same time, this does, you can say it is about just the kids, but she did take a humane choice as well. Like she had her death too, right? She had a hammer and a gun. She could have just
shot her in the back of the head. Yeah. I mean, yeah, you only had one bullet, but you only need one, right? In fact, was only one bullet, she could have been lying about that.
Yes. So I feel like Sim's wife could be more redeemable. Like, I feel like Sim's being in the front line has probably corrupted a little bit of what he was set out to do, which we'll discuss later. But I feel like Sim's wife, all I'm saying is Sim's wife later could side with Juliet believably.
No, and I agree. And I think that, like, there's a line later that, like I said, like you said, we'll talk about it towards the end, but, like,
yeah,
there's more to what's going on with her than we realize, I think.
Yeah. Bits I like in this kidnapping scene. All the dialogue exchange between Juliet and her is really good. Like, it almost read like an action movie, like, like, quippy exchange, except, like, realistic to these characters. I like, I was like, is this my handcuff? Yeah, your husband took my.
I also like that she was still able to assert her own will, be like, yeah, no, I'm not going in the bathroom. I gotta put me somewhere where I can see both you in the door. And, like,
yeah.
So she wasn't a meek victim. Like, she was still, like, playing her hand. And Juliet knew that and was trying to, like, keep things away from her without realizing that she had the keys to the handcuffs in her freaking pocket.
Yes.
Which is also believable because, like, I don't know where she found the handcuffs, but she had no reason to expect that she'd have a key in her pocket.
Yeah. But at the same time, like, the wife, she could, if she went into the bathroom, it would have probably been easier for her to unlock her handcuffs. So she was being genuine. It wasn't a trick. She actually do want to keep an eye on Juliet, make sure, and the son's room, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, yeah.
But I also like Julia's immediate response. It's like, okay, put the knives away, put the tools away.
Although, they're both acting smart. Yeah.
Yeah. Although she didn't put that knife far enough. I think if the wife stretched out, she could have reached those knives.
Maybe. But I also like what we know about the kid, what he says towards the end of the episode about her. Like, maybe she wanted to keep an eye on the kid because if she was in the bathroom, locked up in the bathroom, she was afraid the kid was going to come out and throttle her or something.
Well, try, I guess, Sean. but yeah. So let's skip to Billings and his interactions and his decisions this episode. I'll let you start because you have an interesting note here under the subheading Billings.
Well, the first thing I want to talk about is his wife in this episode and the previous episode. She seems to deliver her dialogue entirely in angry wife. Like, that seems to be her only character trait is angry wife. And it's so, like, grating to me that I don't even care if she's right or wrong. She just sucks. Like, why are they married?
I don't know, man. Maybe I am too cynical about real life relationships. I don't know, because this seems realistic to me. And also at the same time, you're right in that, though. She's kind of right.
She is kind of right. She's not entirely wrong in what she's saying, but the way she's saying it is just so, like, grating. It's so, she's not trying to win an argument. She's trying to just berate the man. Like, she's not trying to make any valid points. She's just, like, belittling him. And I hate that. I can't stand that. It makes me want to side with Billings, even though Billings is also kind of an idiot.
Oh, see, I think we have a completely different read on this one, especially because I think in the previous episode, I kind of been feeling like they've been making her out to be, like, the perfectly understandable wife, except that one time where she was like, are you threatened? Here's all the list of things you should be threatened. But, like, when she shows up to do his work and when he go home and stuff, like, she seemed to be like, oh, honey, like, sit down, you know, like, let me put a hot towel for you. How was your hand? I don't know. It was a little bit too, like, Stefan wifey that, like, I feel like the way...
I don't know. I think she's an abuser.
Whoa, man.
You know, like, the whole, like, 180 of, like, oh, so nice. I'm gonna give you the cold compress and everything, la, la, la. And then, like, just beat the shit out of him later, you know?
Okay, you're escalating this way past the source material, but all I'm saying is that, like, I just kind of feel like I just kind of feel like this is a point where she's losing patience. Like, so I feel like she was like, oh, I'm patient. He's doing what he needs to do. And everything she said in this scene, I'm just like, yeah, she's right, dude. Like what's with the fucking ambitions, you know? And she's right in that, like, hey, I know you're qualified. I'm not trying to tell you you're not qualified. But what matters more to you, like, consistently proving that you are more than your sickness, you can, like, I can do what I can do whatever you do, I can do better. You know, does that matter more to you than all of the fact that, like, you have a fucking child in this world, you know? Yeah.
No, in all seriousness, I think the root of the problem here is not the wife's delivery of her information. I think the root of the problem here is the fact that Billings isn't telling her everything. He should be. Like, he should be telling her absolutely everything that's happening and should not be holding anything back. It would also help him make sense of what's going on, but it would make their relationship too vanilla, and it would make, there would be no conflict, there would be less character confusion. So, like, the story would be less interesting. But, like, that's the root problem in their relationship, is a lack of communication on his part, not her part. But I still say she sucks.
See, I don't know. I like her. Like, I like this speech that she did, because I'm like, I think the difference between you and me is I think Billing sucks. So I don't want to be on Billing.
No, like, side. I said, he is at fault here.
Because, like, what's his response to her being like my read of this conversation would be like, hey, shut the fuck up about proving yourself, like, competing against yourself for a second.
This is getting dangerous. It's not about you. Yeah.
This is getting dangerous. Like, start thinking about whether or not it's worth the danger. And his response is like, last time somebody tried to, like, his response seemed more abusive than her. Like, because his response is like, last time somebody told me that I, you know, like, somebody,
I beat the shit out of him.
Yeah. Somebody made me be aware of my limitation regarding the sickness. I beat the shit out of him. And there is a little moment where she kind of does flinch. Like, he doesn't make any move to hurt her or anything. But, like, what he said something with a hard, like, tone, and she does flinch a little bit in the seat.
Well, I mean, he is a cop.
So I don't know. Like, and they don't wear body cams.
But I think we do get some information in this scene about, like, the greater mythos. We learn a little bit more about the syndrome. It's not an escalating disease like I thought it was. It's more like a long-term thing that you're almost born with, because he had it when he was a kid, apparently. So, like, that's something new we didn't know before. And also, I think it's confirmed just by sheer number of times it's happened that he only seems to show symptoms when he's really stressed out, when, like, something dramatic is happening. Like, that's when it happens every single time.
It seems like a nerve related disease,
right? It's some kind of nerve thing. And, you know, whenever adrenaline's pumping, or whenever any kind of endorphins are going, he's going to have a reaction. That seems to be the case.
Yeah. Probably comes from having to live in a fucking big tin can in the concrete can in the we find out more about the syndrome. You also didn't like the fact that later, when he's searching around, he immediately found what the Raiders missed.
This is just like a writing thing. It's way too convenient for me, and I don't want to say it's like a trope or a cliche, but it almost is, that, like, a whole bunch of Raiders come in and they raid the entire place. They tear down all the walls. They tear down the vent fan and, you know, look inside the vent, yada, yada, yada. They make sure all the glass is off the mirror. You know, they look and scout everything. He goes in, walks immediately to the bathroom, immediately pulls the thing off and sees and finds the book. I mean, yeah, some of that is the editing, but a lot of it is just like, it's convenient storytelling 101. It's just like, let's get him to the point where he does the one thing all of those Raiders failed to do, which is move the very obvious rubber from the seal of the medicine cabinet. Like, it seemed way too easy for me. Like, he didn't have any reason to go there. He didn't have any reason to look in the medicine cabinet. Like,
I disagree with that.
Okay. What was his reason for going in there?
Okay. First of all, two reasons. First of all, stop thinking about what the Raiders are capable of. The Raiders are morons.
I know they're morons, but still,
they're fucking stormtroopers of this universe. Second, I don't think they happened too quickly. The way they edited it, like they edited him looking up at other places, and they cut it in a way that he could be looking. Like, I didn't get the feeling that we were looking at it in real time. He could be looking there for a while. Second of all, they did edit in him flashing back to the moment where he found the duck, the pants dispenser in the glass cabinet when he was raiding. They edited that scene. So what he was thinking, like, he knows now that Juliet planted that there. So the flashback made me think is he realized, oh, when Juliet think hiding place, she think medicine cabinet in the bathroom, because that's where she hid when she was planting the evidence. That prompted him to go check. And then he was initially disappointed because there was nothing there. Of course there wasn't. I mean, the Raiders, as much as they suck, they did open the medicine cabinet. But then he noticed the tape. So I'm okay with that. I think you missed the part.
No, you're right. Yeah. I kind of missed that. I didn't notice that at all. Like, I didn't really think that through. Yeah, maybe you're right. Maybe I take it back. But it's still... Okay, I'm not going to defend it anymore. But yeah, I mean, it was a minor nitpick to begin with.
Yeah. I mean, look, like he did need to find something, but also at the same time, I don't understand. Here's my nitpick. I don't understand why Julia didn't take that with her.
Yeah, true. She left in a hurry, but like she was very careful about hiding it. So I don't know.
True. Well, she is carrying around a lot of incriminating evidence already. What's another book? Another nitpick. Hey, why the fuck did you light that book on fire? like Billings, what are you doing? Like if you're trying to get back into the good books of Sims, which at that point is like we're supposed to believe that that's what Billings' goal is right now, because she left her wife. She left his wife saying, like, oh, I'm sick of people telling me what I'm not able to do. And she said, I'm gonna catch her. I'm going to fix my mistake. He wants to go catch Juliet, and he wants to prove himself to Sims again that he is sheriff material. So at that point, why would you not just take the book, take it to Sims and be like, hey, I found this. Your raiders missed this. I found this. That would go a long way towards getting him back towards Sims books. Is that he burnt it? Also, he didn't burn it in the oven. The alarms are going off. They're going to come back in and find out something. Why not go and dispose of it elsewhere? And like, he just always seemed to be half-assing it. He never seemed to decide what he's actually going to do long-term, because he also ripped out a page.
Yeah, I know. I was about to say, even in that moment, when he decides he's going to burn this thing, he takes out a page. Like,
yeah.
His character is so...
I know, I hate Billings.
And I don't like it. No, I agree with you. I don't disagree that Billings is not a very good character. He's so indecisive. So even when he does make a decisive decision, it's couched in the, you know, I'll take this piece of paper and I'll look at it in my office later. You know, like, why?
Do we see what specifically on the page he took?
Nope, we don't see. We only see like the top of it, but we don't actually see anything that'll tell us what that page is. So yeah, that's like an open question.
Yeah, though every time I see that book, I'm like, man, if these people are this emotionally affected by a trouble book for Georgia, imagine if it was like Disneyland or like Tokyo.
I don't know, man. If they wanted to make sure people stay in the silo, it should have just been Florida.
It's just crime reports of Florida. For
this is
like,
what the outside like world is like.
Yeah. Anything else about Billings this episode? That's where we end, right? Like, he goes back into the office.
And yeah, he's in the office looking at that piece of paper. That's the last we see of him. Like, I don't understand why. A, I don't understand why he burns the book. B, I don't understand why he immediately stops chasing Juliet after that. I'm not sure what's going on with his character. I thought this episode was going to have a lot more to do with him. I thought he was going to do more in this episode. But no, he's still the same schmuck he was at the end of the last episode. Like, he doesn't seem like he's actually learning anything. He's been given all these reasons to choose a side, and he still hasn't done it.
Yeah, yes. And... nothing he does make any sense. Like, I bet he doesn't know. Like, I bet if he turns a corner and run into Juliet, he hasn't decided. he doesn't know whether or not he wants to arrest her or not.
Yeah, and I think by now he should. He should know that by now.
Yeah. Okay, so Juliet recruit more innocent bystander into her path of madness.
Okay, like, I do want another nitpick. The whole thing with the cameras. Like, how is she able to get to Patrick without there being any, like, trail to track her there? Like, I'll buy that Patrick maybe doesn't have any cameras, or maybe she immediately knew where the camera was and blocked it or something. But still, they've got to be able to track her. It is beyond belief at this point that she's able to run around the silo without being caught at some point, without leaving any kind of trace. Even when she's smashing cameras, which we see later, you would be able to track her by which cameras she's smashing, you know? Like, I don't understand how this is happening. Like, it's like I said in the last time, it feels like the writers wanted there to be all this surveillance, but it became inconvenient to the story. So they're just kind of giving her this amazing camera luck.
I mean, you're absolutely right. It's not, it feels like it's exactly what's happening.
Yeah.
the watches have surveillance for the exact room they need to have surveillance to when the plot requires it, and when they need to chase Hurricane Juliet around, they are no longer capable. Which, to be fair, if you really think about it, like, as long as they know where, which room exactly something is happening, it makes sense. They just keep an eye on, like, the rooms in which, like, they, like, okay, we're surveilling this room. But even with intricate system, because remember, they don't have modern things like facial recognitions, right?
Sure.
They're literally a bunch of numbnuts in a room looking at a camera.
They even make a point of it earlier in the episode where somebody says, like, or Sims says that he's, like, hired extra people, or he's gotten everybody out to look at cameras. Yeah. Like, everybody who can look at cameras is looking at cameras right now.
Yeah. So here's my devil advocate things. They have hardly ever have to track people who know they're being surveilled before. So even whatever extra little precautions Juliet is taking probably is way more effective than they used to. Because they used to, like, a level of godlike, the man behind the curtain power, where nobody even really know how cameras work or what they look like, right? Because only people who go outside see the lens and those fuckers are not coming back.
You got a point. Like, the people who are watching the cameras don't necessarily have any, like, experience tracking people who are actively trying to avoid being seen by cameras. But that only makes sense if A, she knows where all the cameras are, and B, like,
she could be wearing a big hat.
Yeah, I mean, she could be, like, hiding like an MCU character. Yeah.
and she could be sticking to places where they are really crowded.
Maybe.
You know?
Like, it's possible. She is. But I don't feel like we've been shown that. Like, the way the show has played out, it just seems like she's just really, really lucky in avoiding the cameras.
Yeah. Oh, look, I am with you that they are not doing this surveillance thing. Like, logically, they're more like, like Schrodinger surveillance. Everybody is under surveillance all at once, except when they can't. Except when the plot requires them to be. Also, why isn't there surveillance in Patrick's room? I feel like they should be surveilling known criminals.
No, like I said, I could believe that she went in there and, like, you know, put a blanket over the mirror or something. Yeah. But even if she did that, they would have noticed. Because, I mean, clearly she hasn't been able to travel through many levels. Like, she's probably, like, Patrick is obviously somewhere near the top because that's where he was earlier. So, like, she hasn't gone far. So I feel like they should be able to find that if she covered it with a blanket. Otherwise, you're right. Why aren't they surveilling her or Bill or Patrick's room? But even if they are, like, why would they be listening at that moment? Like, I don't know.
Also, she's not showing up with those cameras that she's taking out. I'm like, what the fuck is happening? Why is Julia, like, the Batmanification of Julia continued by every episode? She just batarating them from off camera? What's happening?
Yeah, I don't like the smashing cameras thing because she's also doing it really, really fast. Like, they're going out, like, one after another. Like, how is she doing that? Like, without being seen by the camera and knowing exactly where they are. Stupid.
And not giving away exactly where she are by the cameras she's fresh.
Yeah, exactly. Like I said, you should be able to track her by which ones are being smashed.
um Yeah, for a second there, I thought she found something in the hard drive that helped her just shut down the cameras.
Right, right. That's what I was thinking, too. Like, that's the way it was happening. It's going that fast.
Yeah, very funny.
I do like that she had disabled the camera in Sim's room, though. That made sense.
Yeah. Okay, so what else? What do you think about this little dweeby IT guy? I like him a lot.
Like you introduce a character for this purpose, it's a little risky, but like they made the character very likable. His interaction is immediately like, okay, this guy's cool. I can go with this. So yeah, and he's different than other characters we've met like that. So yeah, I like him. I like him a lot, actually. I think he's really cool. I like how he's like, I'm totally not interested. And Patrick's like, yeah, you are. Here, look at that. And he's like, oh, it's the hard drive. He's like, George. And then he's totally in. Like he any skepticism he had before then is gone.
Well, they know George died, and I guess they're acquaintances, so he's immediately like it make it personal to him again.
Yeah, and yeah. It's clear this is not the first time he's seen this hard drive, or at least not the first time he's heard of it. Like he knows that what this is. He knows what's on that. He doesn't know what's on the hard drive, but he knows like that the hard drive was very important and that George was trying to access it and that why he couldn't access it. He even knew like the ins and outs of it. So which was cool. But he does very magically know how to hack in the TV movie way of hacking. But like, oh yeah, sure. This is a little bit more difficult, but here, let me just type a couple of keys and then it'll think it's some guy down in 98.
He didn't even type a couple of things. He just plugged wires in while saying he's going to bounce the signal. And then the next thing we see him do is just log into the
That was a little lazy.
He does have a very realistic bundle of wires. Like, he pulled out a bunch of wires from his bag. I'm like, yeah, like, anybody who's tech-oriented, that's how his their wires are stored, in a big ball.
I've got one right here next to me.
So what do you think about Patrick's motivation in this? I like him. Like, you know,
I mean, I like that he says he's just doing it for the watch, which is like a cynical thing to say. I love it. I think it's great. His character just seems like he's caught. He doesn't really have a choice. He knows it.
Yeah.
He's just doing what he has to do.
And also he has that punk streak of just like doing shit because he
just to do it.
Pisses off. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And I respect that. Sometimes I, you know, steal a traffic cone for no reason.
He's the one character who's been brought into this whirlwind that I hope is okay in the end. Like Lucas, I could give a shit about, but this guy,
Patrick is a snitch. I want him actively to go down. I want Patrick to be fine, and I want the Porter guy, computer whiz guy, to be fine. Okay, so let's talk about this message from George. Cheesy bastard.
It was good to see him again.
Yeah.
And again, it's a little tropey, it's a little cliche to have like a message from beyond the grave, but like it works and it does what it needs to do for the plot. And I liked it. I liked it a lot. And it did have an emotional impact. And like you were saying before, I also think it was genuine. I don't think you lie at a time like that to manipulate somebody.
No, I don't think so. And I suspected that's where he was going as well. Like even at the time where it was discovered that he was like a manipulating womanizer, we suspected that like he did actually do care about thingy.
The con man actually falling for his con. It happens.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like I said, who wouldn't?
Yeah, she's great.
But let's just talk about the content and the mysteries of this thing. George, you fucker. You breadcrumb leaving quest giving NPC motherfucker. What do you mean the water? I was concerned about the water, but it's nothing to worry about. Yo, this is your death video. This is your die video. Say exactly what you did.
Like, that is such a cryptic thing to say, and it's nonsensical, because like at first I'm thinking, okay, if he says that, maybe it's like really, really shallow or something, but no, we saw that light fall into the water and sink to the point where we couldn't see the light anymore. We know it's not shallow, so what is he talking about? It's nothing to worry about.
Yes. You already put this video on a hard drive that is super hard to get into. So
just explain it.
Yeah. The worst.
And whatever. He's not actually going to deliver any information. He's just going to say, okay, the thing you need to see is this next video.
Yeah.
You know, he doesn't give her any information beyond that. It's just like, go look at that. Like, what is she supposed to do next? Like, what else is she supposed to look at? You know, I don't know.
Yeah.
Like, the emotional punch was there, and the purpose of the video for that reason makes sense. But like, what he's actually attempting to accomplish with that video, I'm not really sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like, we know what he's trying to achieve. He's like trying to make sure she keep his mission going, right? And like she keep chasing the truth. But at the same time, like, this is convenient writing bullshit. Like, just you could have said, here's how, like, this is why, like, I don't like this, because they could have gotten around it. They could have been like, and here's how you get around the water, and then cut away. So we as audience don't find it until the next episode. Why does Juliet need to be in the dark too? It makes no sense in context currently, the why George would want Juliet to be in the dark. It makes sense that the writers want us to be in the dark, so we find out dramatically next episode. Just cut away from the video. Cut away from the scene. Okay. So anything else?
Do find out about the door. He like says it's a door, and it's a certain, he's like 10 meters high or something like that.
15 meters high. It's huge.
Something. Apparently. It's a big old door. So like I suspected, that's what's down there. And that's what he was looking for. And I'm more convinced than I was before that she's actually going to go through that door at the end of the next episode.
Yeah. Yeah. Are we going to see what's on the other side?
I hope so. I hope it doesn't pull a Lost on us.
I know somebody who's watching through From right now, and From finally is coming out tomorrow, and she's like so angry. She's like, they're not gonna answer any questions. I fucked up getting into this show. This is one of the creators of Lost. So I hope that doesn't happen to two shows in a row, two shows finally in a row.
I want to see From, but at the same time, I don't, for the same reasons. Like, I'm afraid it'll do the same thing Lost did. And I say
did
that
you
as somebody
watch who, season one?
I did not
I
watch
thought you watched
one.
It. Oh.
No. I'm interested, but like at the time when season one was out, it was on a streaming service that I didn't have. And now I'm not really sure which streaming service to find it on, and I'm just too lazy to go find out.
I thought you watched a couple of episodes, because I remember you talking about it on this.
We talked
podcast.
About the preview before it even came out. Like we talked about it in that respect. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, let's talk about briefly about the video they saw again. Do we see more of it this time?
I mean, we hear audio. We didn't get audio the first time. Yeah. And that's the only difference. Like, we still see the same video. It's just the tree and the birds, and the blue sky. And the green grass. That's about it. That's all we see. We get the audio that she's actually saying something. She's like, I can't believe this is what this is out here. People need to see this, something like that.
The lens is a lie.
Yeah. So like, we now know that people speaking when they're out cleaning, it doesn't come through. Like, we don't, people inside the silo don't hear that. Which we suspected, but we didn't know that for a fact. But now we do.
Yeah. 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 There's not really not much else to go on from that. Okay, so let's talk about little random things as we round up the end of this episode. Let's start with Lucas, that fucking yellow belly snitch. Immediately roll over. We gave him too much credit. We thought he was in some kind of secret organization. No, he's just a coward.
Dope.
Yeah.
I liked the scene though, like mostly for Bernard more than for him, because he went through all those stages of manipulation so quickly. It was very efficient interrogation, only to get information that he should have had already. Like, I'm confused by that. Like, he says, you know, the hard drive had an 18 on it. Didn't Sims already look at the hard drive? Didn't Sims already like see the hard drive with his eyes? Like, he looked in the bag and saw the hard drive. Shouldn't
he
know?
He did, but I don't know how observant Sims is. Sim like to think of himself as a scalpel, but he's a hammer.
True.
Like, he probably didn't register. He's like, hard drive. You know,
maybe.
Like,
maybe you're right.
Bad news. You know, like, even if it's a number, he probably didn't realize it is significant.
Maybe you're right.
We did, like, look, I want to spend 15 minutes shitting on Lucas.
Okay, but, go ahead.
but it does make sense that he's like, if he's not involved in any of the things, like when he seemed to be in a big trouble, which could cost him his life, he does immediately, he was like, what's happening? I don't know anything. And then he spilled everything he knows. But I think we just have too much expectation of him because we think he's in the know about the mysteries of the silo. But no, apparently he just looked at stars.
Yeah, this scene made it very clear that he's just an idiot. He doesn't know what he's anything. He doesn't know anything. Yeah.
Yeah. And they were waiting until this moment to completely destroy Lucas, because we're getting it at the same time where George get redeemed. Before, we were getting it as if Lucas is going to be next George. So we just fell for screenwriting trips, but at the same time, you snitch.
I will say bravo to the writers, though. It was well done.
Yeah. Number 18, though?
This confuses me just because Bernard has a keychain that like has 18 on it, and it starts glowing. So is that like an alarm telling him that the hard drive is being accessed? And if so, okay. I mean, obviously not, because then he wouldn't be needing that information from Lucas. Right.
Correct.
So what the fuck does 18 mean, if not just the serial number of the hard drive? Like, why does he have a keychain with 18 on it? I think that's what throws me. I don't understand that.
I have two theories. He is the 18th, whatever he is, whatever secret dictator man of the silo. He's number 18.
So so the fact that the hard drive is also 18 is just a coincidence?
No, I think it's his hard drive. He didn't realize it's missing. Like, it's probably his. It's probably like a dossier you get when you get inducted into the role.
Oh.
But he didn't realize it's missing.
So why was the keychain glowing?
Well, I don't know about the keychain glowing. Maybe there are other people like who he has to answer to that is like trying to get his attention, right? Because he looked at it again, it's no longer glowing. He's picked it up and he was heading in a different direction in the room. He was almost making to go somewhere, but not towards the door, not towards the one door in his office. So I assume there may be a secret door in his office.
Yeah, I think so too. But like, yeah, he was talking to Sims and he hadn't made any indication that he had hidden the keychain. Like, Sims obviously knew about it, or at least was able to see it. So like, I don't know. But yeah, I agree with you. I do think there's a secret door in there. I think there
in the next scene, he picked up the 18 chain.
And he walks like towards the wall. Well, why would he be doing that if there's not a secret door?
And then he stopped when Sims came and knocked on the door. Yeah.
Right.
Alternative theory. Based on your theory, there are multiple silos. This is silo 18.
Oh, right. Duh. I didn't even think of that. So the guy who has the multiple silo theory, I didn't even think of that.
And it does make sense if the hard drive is everything you need to know about silo 18. Like, because it doesn't even have like blueprints in it.
That's true. I mean, all we know for a fact that's on that hard drive are the blueprints and the video. That's all we've actually seen on the hard drive.
Blueprint video, well, the two videos,
now the George video that he added to it.
I
did think it was funny that they had that one line from the Porter guy where he's like, I don't even know where to start, and the files right there start here. I thought that was funny.
there was a couple of funny moments in this. Raid Walker's place this time.
Yeah, this is something that happens, and it just happens. Like, it happens almost entirely off screen. You only see one little bit of Walker opening the door and letting them in and being like, I have nothing to hide. And I'm like, bullshit, you have nothing to hide. You have everything to hide. What the fuck? Like, so that brings me, that makes me suspect that she knew this was coming and she prepared for it. That she'd like hidden everything that needs to be hidden, or she had well-rehearsed excuses for everything or something. Like, I don't know. It seems like a momentous thing that was just kind of skimmed over, you know? Like, Raiders going into Walker's place seems like it should have been a big deal, but it's really not played as a big deal. All we hear is Sims later saying they didn't find anything, so...
Yeah, but why would it be a big deal, though? I don't see why we needed to see the raid, that's all.
Okay. I mean, I think... It just feels like there's a lot going on in Walker's room that Raiders might be interested in.
Yeah, but she's like, she works in mechanical. She could explain everything away. And Raiders don't know shit about what machines look
That's
like.
That's true.
They
she
are could
idiots.
Be like, yeah. She could be like, this is just the things I've been fixing with mechanicals. And they would have been fine. Like, she's clearly the former mechanical head, right? Like,
she knows how shit works. Yeah.
Yeah. No, like, she's clearly the head of mechanicals before the current guy,
right.
because of how, like, what we see in Juliet flashbacks. So I feel like she has plausible deniability, and they don't care that she doesn't leave her room. So I don't know. I think that's fine. And like, we know Juliet isn't hiding in there, so I'm fine with us not seeing the raid.
It also seems kind of weird to me that they would raid Walker's place, like that Sam's made it a priority to check on her dad and Walker. And then later, when they find it, the signal's been bounced all the way down to, like, level 98. They're like, how the hell did she get from 17 to 98 so quickly? When, like, Walker's at the bottom, right? So, like, how could Juliet have gotten all the way to the bottom that quickly? If she,
but that raid came before they found her in 17. So they could have, like...
Well, I guess it, like, depends on where she was when she jumped. Like,
yeah,
like what level she was at.
And, like, how long it has been. Like, she could have just... going straight down since then and made it to Walker's. But now that they know she was on 17, like a few minutes ago,
yeah, maybe right.
They know she's not a 98. Or she found a secret slip and slide.
She found that elevator.
The part with Sims and Jorah Mormont is good because I was very proud of Jorah Mormont. He's like, he immediately got to the heart of the matter. He's like, would you let people capture your son?
And Sims gives like a rote answer. He's like, of course, yeah. I would, but like, would you really?
Yeah, I don't think that's true. I think he's lying. Bennett manipulating Sims by like dangling the job under his nose.
Very well done. Yeah. Bernard is such a manipulative bastard. I love it.
Yeah. Well, we'll end on that note about the hanging of the job and what it means to Sims.
Yeah.
But do you want to put this note in? So you want to talk about these suspend trips?
Yeah, like there was one scene in particular where like they pulled off some really good like cinematography tricks and some like good storytelling tricks to keep you in a state of suspense or state of anxiety. Like,
yeah.
The drive booting is cliche at this point. Like, if you need a moment to stretch out and, you know, build suspense, you have like, you know, you have the loading screen on the computer, which is what they do here. And they have it intercut with other scenes going on at the same time. But while that's happening, you can see Mrs. Sims, I can't remember her first name, but Mrs. Sims is, you know, getting out of the handcuffs right behind her. And she's obviously not paying attention behind her. So then the camera does this funny thing where it goes right up into Juliet's face. You see Juliet's face looking at the computer, waiting for the loading screen to finish, while behind her, you can't actually see Mrs. Sims anymore because she's blocked by Juliet's face and everything's out of focus. I just thought that was really well done, really clever filmmaking. I just wanted to highlight that. Because I think in every episode, I found something in it that's like a neat little filmmaking moment. And I think that that's for this episode.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree with it. Okay. So let's get to the big enticing, there might be something more here thing.
The big tease, it's almost easy to miss.
Yes. The Sims family.
Yeah. Sims tells his wife.
Yep.
That Bernard was questioning whether or not he would be his shadow. And this seems to cause a lot of concern, not necessarily for the reasons that you would think, because Bernard's wife, or not Bernard, Sims's wife says
that
we have one goal, we have one thing that we've got to keep our eyes on, and we gotta achieve this one thing. We agreed, and this is putting that at risk, apparently.
Yeah.
So it's heavily implied that they've got some kind of plan that involves him being Bernard's shadow. And it doesn't seem like just an ambition thing. It seems like there's more to it than that.
Not necessarily just being Bernard's shadow, just being the person
in
who's in charge of the silo next.
like having Bernard's job. And you're absolutely right. It's not framed as if like, oh, our goal is to get the best job.
Yeah. It's framed like they have some kind of like secret mission amongst themselves, like something that they have like conspiring to do. Which brings in all kinds of questions. Like, is Sims some kind of like deep cover? I don't want to say agent because he's not really an agent of anything, but is he like, is he actually
have a different goal?
Does he have different ambitions than we think? Yeah.
Yeah. Sure is killing a lot of people to get there, though.
Yeah, I mean,
bet his wife doesn't know how many people he's killing to get there either.
I think you're right. I think what it is that he is like, what they're doing is they're trying to get information about the silo, just like everybody else who's curious. But Sims has gone so far in and he's gone so deep into it that he's become a true believer. And it's just like by a thousand cuts, frog in the boiling water kind of thing, you know, where she doesn't know that. So she's still like under the impression that he's going towards that, but maybe he hasn't realized how far he's gone until immediately after this conversation is when Sims's son says, I hope that lady goes out.
That's Simpson.
Yeah. Simpson says, I hope that lady goes out to walk. I never want to see her again. You know, and I'm not entirely sure. I think you kind of see a little hesitation on Sims's part. Like that's a little extreme, which is weird if Sims is who we think he is or we thought he was. So that whole scene raises all kinds of questions and all kinds of possibilities that are building towards the potential for a really big twist involving Sims.
Yeah. But I need to add, if you take a step back and really think about it, the show has made us think that Sim is more bloodthirsty and have more blood on his hand than it is shown.
Yeah, we've only actually seen him kill one person.
And that is the only death that has been confirmed to be directly linked. In fact, the show kind of implied that the death of George and the death of the deputy, both were unintended consequences that a raider got over the top.
Yeah, it was implied that Douglas did it, like the guy that Sims actually killed.
Yeah. But we don't know for sure if the order was to do that. Like, it's heavily implied that it wasn't. They just said, you fucked up with those two. But the fuck up could be, like, not covering his track, or the fuck up could be the murder.
Yeah, sure. And Sims may have had entirely different reasons for wanting to kill him anyway. Like, it may have been that Douglas was, he wasn't getting too close to anything because Douglas was an idiot. Let's not beat around that.
He found out the janitorial door.
He did find out about the janitorial door. That's true. Yeah.
And he was thinking about that guy to be his shadow. Maybe it's simply that he can't fuck up. Like he doesn't want Douglas fuck up reflecting badly on him because his goal is still to get Bernard's job.
Right.
So I'm just saying Sim is a fucker, like a bastard. But he might not necessarily be as villainous as the show is putting us under the impression, but like with enough plausible deniability that they can pull back out later, they'd be like, actually, Sims only killed that one dude. The rest is just kind of being, you know.
And like the times where he's shown to be really evil, nothing actually evil comes of it. Like,
menacing.
He's very menacing. Like that interrogation scene with the old lady, Gloria. Right, Gloria. Gloria Hildebrand. Like he threatens to let her live the rest of her life in misery, but in the end, he gives her what she needs and like lets her go off into oblivion happily ever after. So is he really evil or is he just kind of an asshole? Like who does what he needs to do?
Yeah. What's the end game?
So I think
what's the plan, Sims?
This perfectly sets up the possibility that Sims could be something different. And could be redeemable and could be more of an interesting character actually going forward. And I think that would be a hell of a twist for the last episode moving into season two, which, by the way, we know is not only greenlit, but they've started filming already. So,
Hooray. Wait. Does that mean they have scabs working for them? Because the Raider strike is still happening.
That's true. Maybe they do. But I think they already had a lot of it written before. Probably. This is just a guess. I know I have no inside information. All I know is that they just started filming this week and they just announced that they had greenlit season two earlier this week. So,
yeah. Well, but
right, the part of the protests, and rightfully so, is that writers, you know this, I'm just saying it to the audience, writers are supposed to be involved with the production of the show beyond the writing room, because there's a lot of on-the-fly things to do. Like, some actors might say, oh, this is unnatural dialogue, or what's the motivation? Like, writers are supposed to be on set, is all I'm saying. Like, that's supposed to be part of the job, and they're supposed to be paid well for that. So I'm a little bit skeptical about the show going into production while the writer strike is happening.
No, and I completely agree. And I do think that that is one of the stipulations that is at issue with this current strike, yeah, is whether or not writers are on set every day of filming. Like, they should,
yeah,
be.
Yeah, and they, yeah, should be getting paid accordingly. Like, there are situations in which writers come on set unpaid because studios are counting on the fact that the writers want their products, their art, to succeed.
And you want exposure, be in vision, right? Yeah,
yeah, vision. So, like, they actually show up even though they're not being paid for to do so.
No, yeah, you're right. Yeah, and that's one of the things that's at issue in this particular word I can't come up with. Because strike? The writers are on strike.
This,
I think I was going for negotiation.
Yeah. Ah, okay. Okay. Well, pay the people and let's get back to business as usual, shall we?
Yeah, otherwise season two has been written entirely by AI and it'll just not make any sense whatsoever.
All right. Well, I think that's it for us for now. Like, I think we did all the speculating we could about what's coming next episode.
Yeah, I think we're pretty clear on what we think is going to happen in the next episode. Yeah.
Yeah. So we're very excited about the conclusion. And just let people know, we're going back to where it all started, Foundation. Soon.
We have to go back.
Coming out in July. I think there's like 1 or 2 weeks before that start, and we'll have a couple of short filler episodes, and then we'll go into Foundations. So all the Foundation heads who were listening to us when we were just cracking Foundation, tell your friends who may have dropped off, hey, yeah, we're doing Foundations again.
We're coming back.
Very excited. People keep asking us if we're back. I say we're back. All right, well, until next time, I've been Lynn, and this has been The Streaming Heap.
And I have been Eric, and life is but a stream.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. What's it called when you live in other people's houses? Frogging or something like that? Where you're like hopping from lily pad to lily pad, so they call it frogging. Yeah.
Sounds rude.
It does. It sounds like something you should be looking up on Urban Dictionary.
So we'll be talking about Silo episode 8 for the main portion of
our podcast. 9. Today. Sorry, I forgot to hit the note again. It's 9. That's my bad.
No, I should remember one episode I just watched. 9. Oh, I cannot give you any new information. I am just an AI.